This is Kelly Crager conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Terry Grill. Today is 21 March 2013. I am in Lubbock, Texas on the campus of Texas Tech University. Mr. Grill is kind enough to join me by telephone from his home in Macungie, Pennsylvania. Mr. Grill, to begin the interview, I'd like to get some background information from you if I could. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born October 20th, 1946, in East Greenville, Pennsylvania, or the suburbs of East Greenville. It's a very small town. It's a rural community about 50 miles north of Philadelphia.
Okay. What were your parents' names?
My father was Herman Grill, and my mother was May.
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
I had one sister, Sandra.
Okay. What did your parents do for a living there in Pennsylvania?
My mother was a homemaker. My father was a welder, metal fabricator, you name it, blacksmith. Anything to do with metal or ornamental ironwork.
Well, I guess that would be the right part of the country to be in that sort of work, I guess.
Yes, it was. It was favorable at the time, yes.
Tell me about growing up there in Pennsylvania. What was life like for you growing up in the 1940s and 1950s?
Well, my parents were very conservative, Pennsylvania German. Both of them spoke the Pennsylvania German dialect fairly well. My father was very proficient at it, and I picked up some words here and there. And growing up, we didn't do a lot of traveling. We kind of were stayed at home, and my father was somewhat of a workaholic. He spent many, many hours making the business grow and work.
Tell me about being a kid growing up in the 1940s and 50s in Pennsylvania. What was the atmosphere like there?
Well, it was fairly comfortable. Going to school, you know, meeting other children and having friends, just about like anybody else would have. Again, like I said, we didn't do a lot of vacationing or anything like that. An occasional fishing trip or something like that with my father. You know, it was kind of relaxed. I don't know how else to put it.
Yeah. So were you involved in, did you enjoy outdoor activities, hunting, fishing, sports, things like that?
I was always interested in, yes, playing sports. I was never very good at it. Hunting and fishing, I tried. I didn't have the patience. My father took me small game hunting, and I got my share of things, but just never got very interested in it. Deep sea fishing. First time I went out, I got seasick, but I did catch some fish. I think I went out a second time, but still the same result.
Right.
Yeah, and I just never caught on to it. You know, fishing by a stream and just waiting. Now I'm just not into that.
Right. Right. Where did you go to school?
Upper Perkiomen School District, high school. Elementary school, first grade, I went to, I'd say three one-room schools, but one was a double-decker, so that doesn't count. That's a two-room school. One, in fact, was quite remote and near a pasture, and every morning you hear the frogs croaking, and it picked up the name of Bullfrog Academy. And that was a third grade, one-room school. And then after, I think it was fifth grade, I ended up going to a large school in town. So that was kind of the experience there. And then, you know, middle school, or what was called at the time junior high, and high school. Graduated in 1964.
Okay. Now, the chief issue of the 1950s and into the 1960s, of course, in terms of global issues was the Cold War. What sort of things do you remember about growing up during the early years of the Cold War?
I wasn't that much involved in the news, but of course, when you got older, you paid a little more attention. But I just remember practicing for protecting ourselves from a bomb, taking cover in a hallway and laying down and or under a desk, something like that. It never really, bothered me too much.
You graduated in 1964, as you mentioned. Now, of course, the draft is ongoing at time in the country's history. Did you give military service a thought outside of the draft? Were you interested in joining the military at all?
Yes, my father was in World War II. He was a welder over in Germany, Belgium. I think he got into France, too, a little bit. And I always thought, sure, I'd like to try it. And after I graduated, I was thinking about joining the Coast Guard. I don't know why the Coast Guard, but just picked the Coast Guard. And then when I did finally go to get some information, the Coast Guard office where I was heading was closed that day. And the next day, I received Uncle Sam's draft notice.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Huh.
So, in some ways, I was happy so I could get out and see the world. And Vietnam didn't bother me at the point, at that point, but it was on my mind, but didn't know if I'd ever go there.
Right. Now, you mentioned that Vietnam was on your mind, so you are aware of what's going on over there, and this would have been early, really, in the American consciousness of what was going on in Vietnam. What sort of things did you know about Vietnam by 1964?
Just a little touch base in like our senior year in school. I don't recall a whole lot of it. Just the teacher mentioning that there's this conflict going on over in Southeast Asia, a place called Vietnam. Nobody knew where it was at the time. And he said, some of you may end up over there. And we all just looked at each other, and said, okay, maybe. And that was about it. And we knew that there was forces over there, U.S. forces at the time, but we didn't think it would escalate to what it ended up being.
Sure. Had you given any thought to a college education?
Not really. I thought about going to an architectural school at some point, and my sister had gone to school, but my parents were kind of grooming me to take over my father's business, or at least, working for him. So there wasn't a big push for me to go to any kind of college, and the grades that I got in high school until I got into senior year weren't that favorable. I barely made it at times from year to year, but once I hit junior and senior, I kind of straightened up and started getting A's and B's.
What do you think prompted that change?
I just got more interested in learning about things.
Yeah.
In general. Like science, I was one of the best subjects. I got kind of straight A's in science and biology, but in math, I never did well in math. I always struggled with that in English. And I was more mechanically inclined because I took shop class several years and became fairly proficient at using tools for woodworking and metalworking, which fell right in line with what my father wanted.
Sure, sure. All right, now you are invited by Uncle Sam to join the United States Army. When did you officially sign up?
Well, I was actually drafted
Right.
Let's see, when was it? December 20th, 1965. And being December 20th, we all thought, gee, this is kind of close to Christmas, isn't it? For taking them away from our family and friends. But they put us on a bus, took us to the train in Philadelphia, and we headed down to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, where they put us in tents because they were overloaded, or overbooked, I should say. They didn't have any room for us in the barracks, so we made best we could in Fort Jackson in tents. Didn't think that it would get that cold down there, but it did.
I'm sure, yeah. Tell me about your time there at Fort Jackson. Tell me about basic training as it was, late 65, early 66.
Well, didn't end up taking basic at Fort Jackson because they were, again, overbooked.
Oh, okay.
And they divvied us out to different forts across the country, and I got picked to go to Fort Riley, Kansas.
Is that right?
I took my basic training and AIT at Fort Riley, Kansas.
Interesting. Tell me about basic training at Fort Riley, then.
That was also, I thought when they said, oh, you're going to Fort Riley, Kansas, I thought, gee, it's going to be warm there. Who did I know? the climate was windy, cold in the winter, and it did get hot in the summer, although we weren't there that much into the summer at times. It was a good experience, basic. You know, you're pushing yourself to the limits and seeing what you can get out of yourself. And instead of being what I was, 6 foot and or 6 foot one and 150 pounds when I graduated high school, ended up eating better and exercising better, and ended up, you know, gaining some weight and muscle while I was there. So I kind of appreciated it. And it was a good time because the sergeants, the drill sergeants that we had, weren't regular DIs at the time. They were pulled from other units and placed in our basic training battalions. And they did the best they could. You know, we only had one true DI, and he was our PT instructor. And he made us work.
I bet he did.
Yep.
What about AIT? You don't have to go anywhere for AIT since you're taking it there at Fort Riley.
Well, it's kind of funny because after basic, I was picked to be in an ADM platoon, and I don't even remember the unit that it was. Can't recall. It was an atomic demolition munition for the Honest John rocket. And we ended up having to go to an engineering battalion or company, and that was stationed at Fort Riley. And they told us we were going to have to go for training to Fort Belvoir, Virginia, to get that special training for being in an ADM outfit. But then they disbanded the Honest John rocket, and we were kind of sitting at Fort Riley waiting for what to do, so they gave us honor details, buried a few old soldiers, and polished up some 105 howitzers, and did some parading, and had it pretty easy for maybe a month. And there was a handful of us, maybe a squad. Maybe there were 10 of us or so that were going to do this ADM training. But then because it was disbanded, like I said, we ended up kind of waiting for orders to do something else. And they came and they said, we're going to have to go to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, to get engineer training.
Right.
We hadn't had any AIT yet. So we ended up going to, as I said, Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, did our combat engineer training, and then they shipped us back to Fort Riley. At that time, the 9th Infantry Division was just reforming, and they put us in with all the new recruits that just got through basic, didn't have any AIT yet, so we ended up going through a second AIT for combat engineers. We did help, because we had gone through it, we did help some of the cadre to help them do the instructions.
Mm-hmm.
So we had two AITs, which is odd.
Yes, that certainly is odd. I wonder if you might tell me about this AIT for a combat engineer. What was it? What did it consist of?
Learning how to set explosives, all different types of charges, and building bridges with huge logs, and you had to know how to class the bridges and tying knots and using ropes and building a Bailey bridge and pushing that across a ravine, and the floating bridge, which was pontoons that supported the planks that allowed the vehicles to cross. So it's anything to do with construction, but also learning the combat ways too.
Right.
To defend our perimeters as we're doing our work, and you know, I ended up being fairly proficient at the M79 grenade launcher, and that became my weapon. And I also became a demolition specialist.
What kind of demolitions training are you receiving here? What sort of things are you working with?
Well, we trained with all your TNT and C4, and there was another one called Flexex, and deck cord, and explodes, detonation caps, how to handle it, be safe with it, and how they all can function doing, the job that they need to do.
Right. Was this basically the same at Fort Riley as it was the first time through at Fort Leonard Wood?
I think it was more intense at Fort Riley because I think they were knowing that we were probably going to end up going into combat within the near future.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed it, I think, more at Fort Riley. I enjoyed being in Kansas. I don't know why, but I felt comfortable there.
Right.
More so than Fort Leonard Wood, which is odd because the nickname for Fort Leonard Wood was Fort Lost in the Woods, because it was, very rural. And Fort Riley was close to Manhattan, Kansas, which is a college town.
When do you finish up with AIT?
Oh, boy. I don't recall exactly when we finished up with it, but it was kind of a transition where after we were finished with AIT and the 9th Infantry Division and the 15th Combat Engineer Battalion, we kind of just kind of melted into that at Fort Riley, the station at Camp Funkston, I believe the name of it was. There were different camps at Fort Riley. Custer Hill was where we took our basic training. Funkston and, I can't think of all the names of the different camps that are within Fort Riley. But, we kind of just grew into what we needed to be with the 9th Infantry Division. And then they told us that we were supposed to take leave, and when we came back, we were going to start packing up our gear, and the orders were going to come down that we were going to go to Southeast Asia, but they didn't say exactly where in Southeast Asia.
What did this mean to you at this time?
Well, we all felt that it was going to be Vietnam, but they didn't come out and say it, and we were supposed to go over there in somewhat secrecy. friends and any kind of identification and not tell anybody we were going. And we ended up flying out of, I think it was out of Manhattan Airport, and it took us to Oakland, California, where we boarded a ship, a merchant ship, set up to hold all the troops. And I'll never forget, on, I think it was October the 1st of 66, that we, left the dock at Oakland, California, went under the Golden Gate Bridge. But to our surprise, a lot of people seemed to know we were leaving because they had confetti coming off of the bridge and people up there waving at us.
Is that right?
Yeah. The word got out.
I guess so. What was it like for you to know that you're going to be going to Southeast Asia, probably Vietnam? Did that give you any sort of pause that you're going possibly to a war zone?
Oh yeah, and we felt that that's where we were going. We were heading to Vietnam, but officially didn't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
Until we were halfway there, then they said this is where we're going, and they started telling us about it. So everybody was scared and green and wondering what was going to happen and how it was going to look and what we were going to do when we first got there.
Mm-hmm.
We all thought, what are we going to do, hit the beach? But we're not going to hit the beach in this big ship. How are you going to handle? You're always wondering. You don't know what's coming up.
Yeah. I wonder if you could tell me about this trip over. This would have taken, probably 3 weeks to a month to get over there?
Yeah, that's another interesting story. First day out, I volunteered to be in the kitchen to help, get the, we called it the mess hall in the Army, but I forget what the Navy called it at the time, or the merchants. And it was the first day out after we got out of Oakland and under the bridge. All I remember is that it got rougher and rougher. The ocean was really churning up, and we were into a pretty good storm. And I was glad I was where I was, because everybody in the cots were was getting sick because it was so rough.
Mm-hmm.
So we did all right. All the guys that were in the mess hall did pretty good. You tried to get up on the deck as much as you could to get some fresh air, but it was about it. And it was a long trip. Going over, we stopped in Okinawa for, I think it was about 11 hours. And we had leave that we could go off of the ship, so a lot of guys went into town and had to be back, on the ship, ready to depart. Some of them didn't make it back.
Is that right?
They couldn't find their way back. And then we left and saw a couple large volcanoes along the way once we saw land again, and everybody was looking forward to seeing land.
Mm-hmm.
Then we pulled into Da Nang Harbor, and there were other troops that were on the ship with us. I think there were MPs, a battalion or whatever. I don't remember the size of their unit, and Marines. And I think the Marines or the MPs got off in Da Nang. So we were there for one night, and you could see explosions off in the distance in the hills, and you could hear gunfire and artillery. And it was interesting, but we were hoping we'd never have to see that ourselves.
Sure.
Up close. And then we pulled out of there, I think it was the next day, and headed south, and we pulled in at Vung Tau, I think it was, and they told us that we were going to go onshore, and they were picking all the tallest soldiers to disembark, and we were going to have a parade for General Westmoreland. And we ended up getting in a formation, and we did some speaking, and we stood at attention, and that was hitting the beach for us.
So definitely different from what you'd probably anticipated.
Oh, yeah, we didn't know. And when they told us we were going to go on shore, they wouldn't give us any ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought, why, you can't send us on shore without ammunition. But they told us that we'd be okay, that we're going into a fairly secure area. And it was. It was an R&R center and beautiful beaches. But that we were going to meet Westmoreland there. So that was quite interesting. Then we got back on the landing craft, and before you knew it, I realized today's October 20th.
Is that right?
It's my birthday. So it was quite interesting that they picked us up on an airplane and they got with the Caribou or whatever they called them and opened the back end up and flew us into Camp Bearcat, which was about, I'm going to estimate about 25 miles northeast of Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we disembarked the plane and headed into Camp Bearcat and set up some tents and started building barracks. And so we didn't really see any issues at all the time I was at Camp Bearcat. We did construction work, we built barracks, and we built mess halls. We were doing kind of a construction engineer's work, not combat engineer.
Mm-hmm.
Doing a lot of hauling in our 5-ton dump trucks, and this, that, and the other thing. It was just, busy work, making that Camp Bearcat suitable for the 9th Infantry Division, the remaining part of the large 9th Infantry Division to come in and set up in Camp Bearcat.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you mentioned, or as you alluded to, Camp Bearcat was not complete at this point. There's a lot of construction that goes on at this early time. Can you describe for me what Bearcat looked like when you arrived?
I don't recall, but I don't recall seeing too many constructed barracks. And when I say barracks, they were wooden structures with screening and slats. And for the roof, they take a tent, like a squad tent, or I forget what the size of it was, and drape it over to be your roof. And they had maybe a few mess halls, but not many. And a lot of the wooded area came up from the north. It came into the camp pretty close. And that's part of the job that we were supposed to do, is help clear some of that area to get a little better field of fire between us and the woods. But as I said, we never experienced any kind of mortar attacks or anything while I was at Bearcat.
Mm-hmm.
I recall one night that I was on guard duty and I saw a huge explosion in the direction of Long Bend. And I think it was it was an ammo dump in Long Bend, near the air base there. And they hit an ammo dump with a mortar round. But that was maybe 8-10 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
So I just really saw the flash of it. And it ends up that now a friend of mine was stationed right there, and it blew him out of his cot. So, thinking back and knowing all that, I knew that he was actually there, and now he's a friend of mine.
That's really interesting. What were your impressions of Vietnam, the country itself, when you first arrived?
Well, I think the first thing that you come up with, there was a distinct odor or aroma. I don't know which one you call it. It wasn't that pleasant, but I don't know. Was never to the tropics ever before, and it was quite interesting. I was learning so much because I was quite naive about what the world was like,
mm-hmm.
and this was quite an experience for me.
Yeah, I wonder if you might expand on that for me. You say you were learning things and coming over rather naive. What sort of things were you picking up on?
Well, the people in general, the way they lived, and how friendly some of them were, but yet, wanted to keep their distance because they could get in trouble if the VC were around. Trying to earn a living, farming, children, trying to sell, things along the road. When you pull over, they want to sell you something to drink, or I think it was pineapples on a stick and things like that. That you didn't know if you should trust it or not, but you did, and you survived. I'm here to talk about it. Yeah. But, all we thought about is this safe to drink or eat.
Right.
And just the country itself is beautiful. I wish I had the opportunity, and if I get it, I'm going to see if I can't go back to see it now. But it is a beautiful country. One thing that I remember is beautiful sunsets. That's always stuck in my mind. The different odors when we were out on patrols or somewhere near population, there was a hint of, and I still, when I smell it today, and it's when autumn comes and people start gathering their leaves together and start burning their leaves. So I think it was from some of the vegetation that they might have been burning for their fires, for cooking and things like that, for bathing.
Yeah.
So that's my flashback. When I smell that, I think of Vietnam.
Right. Were you?
I don't know if anybody else mentioned that, but there's just that odor when you're burning wet leaves.
Yeah, I've heard many times that some of the strongest memories are triggered by the smells that you remember from that time.
Yeah.
Interesting. Were you with the 15th at this time, or had they assigned you to a unit yet?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Were you with the 15th Combat Engineers at this time, or had they assigned you to anyone?
Oh, yes. We all went over together. The 15th Engineer Battalion, we all went over together. We were advanced party for the 9th Infantry Division, as I said, to build up temper cap so that the 9th Division could move in there and have, room for all their people. And then after we got finished at their Camp Bearcat, just before the 9th started moving in, they said we were going to move down to Dong Tam along the Mekong River. And that's where I ended up for the rest of my tour.
Okay. Take me through a typical day here at Bearcat. What would you be doing, say, from the time you woke up through your entire day to the time your day was over? What would a typical day consist of?
Most of the time, we were doing construction work, building barracks, carpentry work, mess halls. There was a big push to get mess halls done because they needed to feed all the guys when they got there, and they wanted them to be in a good environment when they arrived. The mud was another thing that you had to deal with, so we used to have to build walkways out of PSP or whatever you can get your hands on. I don't know, PSP is pierced steel planking. It's used a lot of times for roadbeds or airport runways. And we did that also. We built a runway for the airport. I did a lot of truck driving, dump truck. We used to go to the laterite pit off base and bring the trucks back in and spread it out and help building the runway for the aircraft to come in. As I said, building barracks, clearing brush, always out in the areas where we were trying to get the wooded area moved back away several hundred yards. And there was always brush to clear up, and there too I used to drive trucks. So I did a little bit of everything. I wanted to experience everything because I had, you know, we had to drive trucks 24/7, you know, to keep moving, and sometimes you'd meet somebody on the night shift, and then you'd end up driving truck. Definitely during the day, you'd get some time off, but then you might go into doing carpentry work again.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was quite interesting.
Mm. Now, how long were you at Bearcat before you moved down to Dongtam?
Trying to remember, we got there on October the 20th, and I spent New Year's Eve at Bearcat, and it was maybe January, late February, maybe January, that we ended up going down to Dongtam.
Mm-hmm. Now, did the whole engineer battalion move down itself?
Not the entire. It was like a couple companies went down first.
Yeah.
Maybe A, B. I was in Delta Company, D Company, and we went down. Had no barracks at all. I don't know if you're familiar with Dongtam, but it was originally kind of wetland, rice paddies, whatever, and the Army started building it up, and there were two dredges out in the delta, in the river, Mekong River, dredging. One of them was called the New Jersey Dredge, and they were pumping the sludge, silt, whatever they got off the bottom, into an area just, oh boy, it would have been north of us, and filling it in, and allowing it, it was like it's very sandy, drain out, but wet and sandy, and they just kept building it up, several feet, maybe 5, maybe 10 in some places, 10-foot deep, and that's when it got very interesting, because when we got there, like I said, they didn't have any mess halls or barracks, so we lived in our pup tents for, I think it was about 4 weeks until we had several mess halls built, and then we finally ended up building some barracks, two-story barracks, and we were complaining because we were in the tents and the other guys were coming in and starting to occupy the barracks, but finally we got into one, but I think it was at least a month, maybe a little more, that we were in the pup tents, which was terrible.
Those would have been rough conditions, I would think. To
yeah, that was bad. That was some of the worst living conditions that I can remember.
I wonder if you can tell me about these kinds of living conditions, whether it's the ground or the possible rain or the insects or wildlife or foliage. What sort of things are you dealing with on a regular basis here?
Well, there was basically no foliage in our area because it was all filled up with this silt or sand from the dredges, and it had dried out pretty well, but always rained, and your sleeping bag and your poncho liner and everything was always damp and wet, and we tried to dig a trench around the pup tent so that, you know, the water could at least drain into that and wouldn't flood you out. You had air mattresses you'd blow up and hope you wouldn't float away. But it, lots of rain.
Yeah.
Lots of mud. Well, not there so much mud, but wet sand.
Yeah.
And, you know, when it was mass time, they had the Marmite cans and you had to wash your utensils. You know, you used your I can't think of the term now. Canteen, cup, and your mess gear and everything, and you used that. You didn't have any other utensils, trays or dishes or anything like that. So it was quite an experience, and I think the worst, that wasn't the worst of it, it was just the conditions of, you know, laying down at night, if you did lay down at night or whenever you got the opportunity. It was always wet and damp.
Mm-hmm. Here you are, a young man from Pennsylvania. You're in Vietnam. You're in
18,
this...
19 years old.
Yeah. And here you are in the war zone. Was this your idea of what a war was going to be like?
Well, up until this point, we hadn't experienced any hostile forces.
Mm-hmm.
To our surprise, you know, you always expected it, but you didn't. Once we did get more established, the perimeter guard became an essential thing. Before that, there were Army infantry men that were guarding the perimeter of our camp. But then afterwards, there became need for everyone to participate. So you always assume, you know, every couple of days you had to do perimeter guard.
Mm.
And again, it was a long time before we experienced any issues as pulling perimeter guard. The only one that I recall is hearing off in the distance a thud, thud, thud kind of a sound, and pretty soon we heard this whistling going over our heads, and we all looked at each other. This was at night, you know, pretty late at night. You know, what the heck is this? You know, here, the mortars were coming in on us, and they were targeting the ammo dump, which was back behind us in the center of the camp, and they hit some of it, and some fell short, and one hit one of the latrines, and there were some guys that were very close to the latrine, and they got hit, literally, with waste, not necessarily anything else. But then they came running down to our position, and we kind of shooed them away because they didn't smell too good.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure.
It was scary, but yet comical at the time.
What is it like to be here at Dong Tam, and again, a young man from Pennsylvania, receiving mortar fire for the first time? What goes through your mind? How do you react to that?
Yeah, it's just, you took cover, hoping that one didn't fall short.
Mm-hmm.
Take your position. You know, you're trained to, you know, not to take it the best you can and not be scared, because you didn't know after the mortar attack were we going to get ground forces coming at us. So the position I was in, it wasn't likely because there was a canal, a fairly wide canal between us and where the enemy would have come.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an incident where that I thought through, I had the night vision scopes at the time, the binoculars, and I thought I saw something across the way, and we couldn't tell, and everybody said, yes, it looked like a face looking at us. So they said, fire a couple of M79 rounds into that area, and I did, and it disappeared, so I don't know.
Yeah.
Again, I said it was at night. It could have been just foley that looked like a face. Couldn't be too sure, but
sure.
We got permission to fire, and we did.
And how long did this mortar attack last?
Oh, minutes.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't take long once they start firing to pinpoint where they're coming from, and that was the first night that I actually saw Puff the Magic Dragon spraying the area with M50 machine gun fire.
So they called in Puff the Magic Dragon for this, then?
Yeah, yeah.
That must have been quite a sight for you.
Oh, it was. It was, you know, if, how far away was it? It seemed like quite a good distance, but it could have been a mile or two away from us. But yeah, you could see the gunfire and all the tracers that come out of that. It looked like they were just spraying it with a water hose.
Wow.
So it was quite an experience.
Yeah, I would guess so.
And it probably lasted maybe 10 minutes, 15 minutes if that, that we heard the mortars going over our head. So, and it wasn't consistent. It was, you know, maybe three or four, and then nothing for a little bit. So we figured somebody was observing to see where they landed, and then gave them adjustment. And then maybe another three or four would come over, and maybe another three or four. But all of this probably took place in maybe 15-minute span.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said, then Puff the Magic Dragon came on the scene, and then it stopped.
Yeah. Well, now it must seem that you are officially in the war after you've been mortared.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. What do you do in the aftermath of an attack like this?
Just clean up, look for any damages. Because we were engineers, we had to maybe reconstruct something.
Mm-hmm.
Don't recall that there was too much damage other than the fire caused by the ammo dump. And it wasn't that bad that I recall. The mess hall and barracks, I don't recall any of them getting hit. We all had, you know, bunkers right outside the barracks that the men could get in. And the only other that I recall was that one that fell short, that mortar that fell short that hit the, I think it was like a four-man latrine. That was the only one, and we all kind of looked at each other and said, man, that one came close, because it was only maybe 20 yards away from us.
Wow. As an engineer, are you tasked with building the bunkers outside of the barracks?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Tell me how you would put together a bunker. How would you build one of these things? What would go into it?
Oh, just start throwing sandbags, and it was basically all sandbags. And you build it up to about 4 foot high, maybe a little more. And then we get some timbers or some of that PSP planking and lay it across for a roof. And then we pile it full of, you know, a couple of more layers of bunker sandbags to hopefully take a direct hit from a light mortar. And you have, you know, room enough in there for maybe a squad. And the barracks that we had maybe three or four squads in it. Don't recall exactly, but there were bunkers built that could hold maybe two squads. Mm-hmm. I think that's how we did it. And one at one end of the barracks and one at the other. And the downstairs guys would go into one bunker, and upstairs would go in the other. And we had drills, and once in a while you'd have incoming rounds, and you always could tell an incoming round from an outgoing round, because they were constantly firing whatever it was, 105 howitzer rounds out. But you could be sound asleep, and you could tell when one was a mortar was coming in. And there were times that happened, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And then we ended up having to protect the New Jersey dredge. As I mentioned before, there were two dredges. I don't recall the name of the other one. And I ended up being in charge of the mission to go and protect the dredges. And what we ended up doing was taking a boat, and it was just a half ponton. And if you're familiar with the pontons that hook together, to make a bridge.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a half ponton, and we put a 15-whatever horsepower motor on the back of the thing. And we take maybe a guy out. Never went out alone, so there was always at least one other fella. And we have a schedule, and we go around the dredges and drop small quarter-pound charges or quarter-stick charges of TNT to pack them. Because the one dredge did get damaged by an explosive device that was placed there by a VC that had, I guess, swam out and put the charge next to or under the dredge and damaged it.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to constantly protect it.
Yeah. How often would you be in charge of protecting this dredge?
Well, there for a while it was every night, every day. Don't recall the schedule, but sometimes it was on during the day, but most of the time it was on at night.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also run the boats out. There were maybe three boats, and we'd all go out, do our rounds, and come back onto the Mekong River. And that was an adventure at times, too, because the current was very swift at times. And I recall one incident where I was piloting the boat, and I was trying to get to the dock by the dredge, but the current was so rapid, and my small motor couldn't steer away from the dredge, and we ended up hitting the dock of the dredge, and I ended up flipping backwards into the water.
Hmm.
And luckily, an infantry man that was right there and saw this happen put his rifle down, and I grabbed a hold of it, and he pulled me back onto the dock, up onto the dock.
Good thing he was there, huh?
Oh, yeah. And my helmet ended up at the bottom of the river. So I had to quick find another helmet, go to supply. But that was quite an adventure. That was close, because, you know, if you get sucked in under the dredge by the current, it could end up dredging you up.
Yeah, that'd be big trouble.
Oh, yeah.
Are you armed at all when you go out to protect, other, of course, than the TNT that you were using?
Yeah, I always had my 45, which was the weapon of issue if you had a 79 grenade launcher.
Mm-hmm.
So I always had at least the 45 with me at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But luckily I had that strapped to me and I didn't lose that.
Right. We should make mention, I guess, that the reason you were dropping, or maybe you should tell me, why were you using these quarter sticks of TNT and dropping them outside around the dredge? What would be the purpose of this?
Well, if you have any divers that are going underwater and you drop a charge, the concussion or the shock wave would burst their eardrums or do damage to their body.
Mm-hmm.
If they were within a certain range. I don't know what it would have been, but usually dropped a charge towards the rear and then alongside maybe one or two, and then you go around the front, drop one, and you'd circle it at least once or twice at a fair distance. The fellas that were on the dredges would tell you if you're too close because they could feel the shockwave.
Yeah, I'm sure that they would let you know.
Oh, yeah.
How big a dredge was this for someone who's not initiated with the size of these things?
I don't
things?
Know how you'd go by size, but it's huge. It's
mm-hmm.
big. They used to invite us up to have leftovers. If they had a meal at night and they saw we were down there risking our lives to protect them, they'd invite us up to partake in some of the meals that they had. But I recall one time, or maybe several times, the food was always good, but there were some kind of beetle or insect that would get in it, and when you ate your mashed potatoes, that's where you saw it. Mm-hmm. They look like raisins in your mashed potatoes. So you just push them aside and get rid of them and eat the potato. Another good experience.
Yeah. I guess depending on your definition, I guess.
Yeah. Big beetles, or what kind of bug it was, were all over the place on the dredges. Mm-hmm. I don't know why they hung there, but maybe they liked the light or something. But mm-hmm. they ended up finding their way into the mashed potatoes. I remember that vividly.
Would the dredge run 24 hours?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which would make sense, given the size of the task mm-hmm. that they were trying to accomplish their building up there at Dongtam. Tell me about your typical pace of life there during the day, in addition to building things, building bunkers, putting up barracks, protecting the dredge. What other sort of things would you do, say, when you were not on duty?
Well, you'd go to the day room, play cards. I didn't partake of alcohol at the time. I didn't like beer. Where a lot of guys did, so I used to drink, you know, soft drinks.
Mm-hmm.
We had a pretty good mess sergeant that would sometimes make up some French fries and bring them up to the day room, and the guys could partake. We had a television and, you know, radio and all kinds of games that you could play for fellas that wanted to do so. And then we had a projector and... every night I think we had movies. Sometimes you saw the same movie over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot of Elvis movies and a lot of Marilyn Monroe movies. I remember Elvis. You didn't have that many films to watch, so you just watch them over again, and then you put it in, and the guys would see what it was, and then you get razzed.
You mentioned the television. What sort of programs would be on television?
Just the armed forces, whatever we could pick up.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't anything special. I don't recall watching it that much.
Mm-hmm. What about music? Did you have any chance to listen to, say, Armed Forces Radio Vietnam?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all the time. And what was his name? Good Morning Vietnam. He, I think, was there, but he left just as we arrived or shortly thereafter.
Mm-hmm. Adrian Cronauer.
Cronauer, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there was a girl that was the announcer at the time that I was there, most of the time. I can't remember her name. And then you always had Hanoi Hannah, too. She was on the radio from Saigon, I guess it was. Or not Saigon, but Hanoi.
Mm-hmm.
Hanoi Hannah.
What kind of music comes to mind when you think about this time?
Oh, all the good music from the 60s. Still love them, you know. All the rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the guys were into listening to country and western.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a couple friends that were, you know, tuned in their radio. I think it was on Armed Forces Radio, the Grand Ole Opry
mm-hmm.
from Nashville, Tennessee. That was a popular one. And we all enjoyed it. And, fellas in the barracks, they always were playing records or get elaborate tapes of music and be playing them. Again, you hear them over and over again, but I think they got etched into your mind.
I would imagine so.
I mean, any movie that you watch, they're all usually playing that kind of music.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The Temptations and the Four Tops.
Mm-hmm.
The Wonder and all of those. Atypical.
Mr. Grill, I hate to stop us after just getting started today, but I'm going to need to stop here for today.
Okay.
This is Kelly Kreger continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Terry Grill. Today is 26 March 2013. I'm in Lubbock, Texas on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Mr. Grill is kind enough to join me again by telephone from his home in McKenzie, Pennsylvania. Okay, Mr. Grill, when we left off last time, we had you there at Dong Tam, and you were explaining the setup of things down there, and you were talking about this one mortar attack that you suffered while you were there. I wonder if you can pick up the story there. What was going on down in Dong Tam, and what was going to be the role of your unit down there?
Well, our role was to support the infantry. When they'd go out on a mission, they would send a certain amount of combat engineers that had demolition training.
Mm-hmm.
And I was one of them, and we would accompany them on several small missions that I recall were somewhat close to Camp Dong Tam, and really didn't get much action until they started to put us on a helicopter and took the whole infantry unit and ourselves several miles out into the jungle somewhere. Didn't know where we were going exactly, but I always tried to get a seat by the door so I could see the scenery, but maybe that wasn't such a good thing. It was always, you know, our door was always open when we were flying.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the first missions that I recall that I went on had some spotty firing. I don't know if it was from snipers or what, but we had set up a perimeter after we had left the helicopter. We set up a perimeter, and some of the infantry went out, as I recall. And I was kind of, you know, very green at it, along with everybody else. And they went looking for the sniper, and evidently they caught up with him, but I'm not sure. Evidently, they did hit someone in our unit, and we set up for the evening, and they put body bags right alongside of where I was trying to settle in for the night. And it was a little scary situation, you know, and feeling sorry for those soldiers that got killed in that action. And it, like I said, it seemed to be very light at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Only a few shots, and I guess the enemy sniper was a pretty good shot.
Mm.
And another mission that we went out on, one of the first that we came under heavy fire, I was behind the infantry, and I was kind of alone with a few guys off to my flanks, but maybe 20 or so yards behind a berm where our infantry guys started firing, and I hit the deck, and I could see the shells going through the grass right alongside of me, and I didn't know if I should roll one way or another, because the firing was coming pretty good. You could hear them whizzing past your body as you lay there, and you could actually see it, like I said, skimming through the grass.
Hmm.
I must have been at the low point where they were hitting the ground.
Yeah.
That was quite a scary situation. One of the ones that I remember pretty freshly in my mind.
I wonder if you might be able to take me on one of these missions from the very beginning, from, say, the night before, if you know you're going to go out, what sort of things you're doing to prepare, then saddling up, as it were, getting on the helicopters, going out. Can you take me through an entire mission from, say, the night before?
Well, you'd make sure that you had all your gear and everything ready to move out in the morning, and get all your orders, what you were supposed to be performing, what you'd have to look out for. Usually it was kind of a routine preparation. Don't remember all the details, but in the morning when we woke, we had to get the explosives that we were going to be carrying in a sack. There were usually about, I think it was around 40 or 50 pounds of some type of explosives, including some deck cord, claymore mines, blasting caps, and we you know, go to wherever I had to pick that stuff up and head down towards the helipad and prepare to take off with the unit. And, you know, as I said, when we get there, hopefully it wasn't a hot zone, but sometimes we land in some of those where you'd have to jump out, and the helicopter didn't really come to a landing. It just hovered, and you'd have to jump out. Some of the details, I don't recall everything, but as we go on the mission, if it was, depends on if it was a hot or a cold landing, regroup in a jungle area with the unit that you were sent out with the platoon or the squad that you try to stay with, the officer, lieutenant, radio man, medic, chaplain, and myself, and maybe a few other individuals, and we'd get our orders to move out, and if they found any booby traps, they were mine to take. Usually had no issues with anybody falling into any or stepping into anything. I don't recall anything right alongside of me or in the vicinity that I could see that anybody ever stepped in a booby trap, in a bungee pit, things like that. They were pretty rudely made, or crudely made, I should say. But if we found one, we'd just take a small charge or a hand grenade and toss it in and make sure that it was broken up so that no one could get injured.
I see.
Get rid of the bamboo spears that were in it. And they were usually only large enough that maybe you'd put your leg into it and you'd cut your leg or something. But like I said, I never saw anyone be injured by one of those. Then we also run into bunkers. And if they were, unoccupied because we run across them, those also, I'd get an infantry guy to hold my legs, and I'd wiggle in because I was long and skinny at the time. Wouldn't fit now. But I'd set a charge up near the roof, and just enough to lift the roof and break it back down again.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just usually made out of, sticks and mud, very crudely made also. And if we run across any issues with, I'm trying to think of the times that we had found ammunition that was either left behind or we confiscated it in some way or another. It could have been shells, cartridges. It could have been some small rockets or mortar rounds, claymore mines, anything that the enemy would have had. And we put it on a pile, and it was my job to put a charge into it and blow it all up. So that's about what our normal day would be out in the field, and until the mess helicopter would come in and hopefully bring us some hot rations. If not, we'd have to use our sea rations. And we could heat them up with some of the explosives that I was carrying, so a lot of the infantry guys would come over and get a small marble-sized piece of explosive, and you'd light it, and you could heat your sea rations and have hot tea that day.
Mm-hmm.
So that made us pretty popular.
I'm sure.
All of the engineers had that same experience.
How many
Then, if we were going to be staying overnight, then you'd set up your air mattress and poncho liner, whatever you had, and make yourself comfortable, and hopefully you weren't chosen to be on any kind of a watch that night, but there were times where I had to be on an outpost to just as a security, a listening post.
Mm-hmm. About how many of the combat engineers would go out, say, on a platoon size sweep or a company size sweep?
Usually two.
Mm-hmm.
I think I there could have been myself, because I was the ranking one at the time, and another fella going out with the same platoon, but with a different squad. I was usually with the officer, because I had the M79 grenade launcher, as did the others. But for some reason, the officer always seemed to pick me, I guess, because I was considered the sharpshooter with the grenade launcher.
Okay.
Because of some other incidences that came up where he wanted me to lay a couple rounds into an area, and I hit it pretty good with the first, second, and third rounds.
Hmm. Yeah, you'd mentioned before that you had become pretty proficient with the M79.
Yeah, I was able to use the old Kentucky windage kind of thing. I didn't use the sights too often. Some of the guys did, but we got to the point where we knew pretty good, pretty well how to angle the 79 so we get it to the distance that we wanted and make up for the trajectory that it takes, because it curves slightly, like a baseball would curve,
mm-hmm.
because of the spinning action. I know one time an officer said, can you put one in that window, because there was a shack out in the middle of nowhere where we did run into some enemy forces, and he said, can you put a shell, a 79 round in that window? And I said, I'll try. Well, I think the first time I hit just above it on the roof, and then the next time it hit right on the, you know, dining room table.
Hmm.
Yeah, there was no one in that we know of at the time.
Right.
He just wanted to make sure.
Sure.
And another one that came up one time, we were out in the mission, and we were set up for the night, raining pretty hard, and I was kind of getting to the point where I was, you know, pretty relaxed in my poncho and air mattress, and I heard somebody running. It was like it was running right past me or jumped over me or something. And here, evidently, it was one of the VC hiding in the perimeter under a shack that he was hiding all day while we were in that area. And then when it got dark out, he figured he could make a run for it. He must have jumped right over me and then jumped into a canal that was going by. And everyone opened up fire into the canal. And I threw a couple hand grenades, and it was too close to fire a 79, but we don't know if we got him, but I think they said they found him floating the next day down the river somewhere. So there's some pretty hairy moments when I think, you know, if I would have been sitting there, if he would have done something, but I blended in pretty well with the surroundings because I was laying down in my poncho covered up.
Can you describe for me what it's like for you, a combat engineer, to go out on one of these missions, humping through the geography there? What was the geography like? What's the, you know, the flora like? Describe the weather. What's it like to go out on one of these?
Well, in the area that we were, it was pretty flat and muddy. As I said before, a lot of rice paddies. When you did walk and you had to go through a rice paddy, you always went up on the berm, even though you shouldn't have, but trying to go through the rice paddy is like, you know, as you can imagine, walking through mud that goes above your ankles. And other than the flatness of the terrain, the jungle, really heavy growth, banana trees and palm trees and all kinds of shrubbery that you had to make your way with. And a lot of times we stayed on trails, but you had to be very careful there too because of some type of booby trap that might be set up or snipers. You need to get to some areas where there were not necessarily canals, but little streams, and they just had a log that they put over to cross the stream, and you had to walk across this, and after, you know, 50 or 60 guys went ahead of you, it gets a little wet and slippery, so the trick was to get a pretty good running start and take as few steps as you had to get across to keep your balance. Because there were some instances where some guys did slip and fall in, and that's a mess. If you did go in the water, you come out, and a lot of times you were full of leeches. They somehow attach themselves to your legs or your body, and they get onto you, and then you had to have somebody pull them off, and then you had, if they were on too long, they were sucking away, and the medic would have to treat you a little bit to, you know, clean the wound up. That wasn't too nice.
I'm sure. What kind of toll does this take on your body? I mean, granted, you're a young man here, but what is it like to go through this day after day?
Well, like everybody else, you know, hopefully you were in shape, and the Army put you in shape before you went over, and, I was 6'1" and probably weighed 165 pounds, 180 pounds, somewhere in there. And, I did all right keeping up with everything. There's no problem. I had a pretty good load with that grenades and Claymore mines and, like I said, about 50 pounds of explosives, C3, Flex-X, deck cord, things like that.
Yeah.
You were in pretty good shape, so, I didn't affect me too much that I know of, other than the results now that Agent Orange got caught up with me and got diabetes, and I'm getting coverage for that from the VA.
Yeah.
Several missions that we went out on, that one that sticks out in my mind the most is June 19th. Never forget that. When June 19th comes around, I always have flashbacks about that day. Lost my best buddy that day. He was in some boats. We had all the canals that we were going up and down and things. They had some small boats where, maybe five or six guys would be in the boat. And we'd be on land, and for some reason this day he was on the boat and they got ambushed, and that was probably the worst battle that I can recall that I was in. It was in the Rack Guy, I think it's called Rack Guy area,
Rock Jaw maybe?
Rack Guy River. And probably the worst day of my life, because we were really pinned down. The enemy was well positioned in bunkers. We had our boats, the one with the 40 millimeter cannon, came up the canal to try to take out a bunker that was the one that was initially responsible for taking out the boat. They were, from what I heard, they had a 50 caliber size machine gun in that bunker, and that's what took the boat out where my buddy was on. And, we were very close, and we shared a lot of things. Back on the, I don't know if I recall telling you about the barges that we were living on at the time that Benoit was one, and Vernon County, I believe, was the other one. we'd be on those for about a month, and then we'd go off with the armored troop carriers and make our landings. Didn't need the helicopters anymore at that point. They may pick us up occasionally to move us to a new location, but coming back to the barge, it was a troop barge set up to house, you know, the battalion. And it was nice when we get back there because it was nice and dry and we had good meals the Navy put on for us. But every time we went out on a mission, we'd be out for, like I mentioned, I think before, we were out for, the most was 3 days. But it was always nice coming back to them.
Sure.
Getting back to that June 19th battle that we were in, Alpha Company ended up with a huge amount of casualties, along with B Company. And I recall that I was with C Company, and we had several casualties. In fact, we were just ready to sit down for the noon meal that we, our lieutenant said, we'll move up into this location by this hooch, and we'll take a break and have lunch. And just as he finished saying that, we got fired upon, and that's when the day started. It was quite traumatic, to say the least. This is the same battle that I sent you information about the, what was it, the chaplain.
Right.
Wint Miller.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall his name, but I know there was a chaplain there, and I was right beside him with that, if you refer back to that letter that he sent to his wife.
Right.
That explains a whole lot for the day. He said it as well as I could have said it. The officer that I was with, he got shot, but with a hand, into the hand. It was a wound, a minor wound, he said, but he kept fighting. We had a radio man that got hit. I think I was the only one out of the five or six of us that were with the lieutenant that didn't get hit, but I know that I got, it came close because a shell hit the heel of my boot. I believe it was from the same fellow that was firing at us from a hooch about 100 yards away, and that's when I stood up and fired as many as I could rounds of M79 into that area of the hooch, hopefully getting whoever was firing at us.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know. We'll never know.
Yeah.
But the officer at that point needed a radio man, so I pulled the radio off of the fellow that was wounded. It was a gut shot. And I commenced to using the radio to call in for airstrikes, what the officer told me, and the helicopters were coming in, and they were scraping the area. In fact, they scraped to the point where they thought we were some of the enemy, so I stood up and waved, and they could tell because I was so tall, I guess, and that it was an American soldier. They stopped firing, but the rounds were hitting all around us. And then they started to bring in some jets, and they were dropping bombs, but the approach that they had to take was behind us. So when they drop a bomb, it was, you know, a couple, you know, 100 yards behind us, and it would go right over our head, and you could just see this bomb heading to the bunker and to the area where the VC were, which was, you know, 100 yards or less away from us. So that was something to see those bombs coming down, and hopefully they didn't drop too soon because they just went, you swear you could just throw a stone up and hit them.
Hmm.
That's how low they seemed to be. So it was quite a time through that. And then because we had so many wounded, the helicopters started coming in to do medevac. And the first one that came down got some wounded soldiers in it. And I remember it taking off and didn't get up very high. And they must have got hit somehow because it actually flipped upside down in the air. And we could see some of the wounded soldiers that were in there falling out. They might have been about 30 or 40 feet off the ground at the time. And that helicopter crashed, needless to say. Another one came in, tried to do the same. He didn't get very far. He spun around and came down. He didn't get up, you know, 5 feet. So when he got hit, it just spun him around and hit the rice paddy. So knowing that we had some need to get some people over there, I grabbed as many weapons as I could, because we had so many weapons laying there, and I didn't want to leave them from the guys that were wounded at where the berm where I was, And I hurried over to where the helicopter had come down, and that's where I probably was right alongside of Chaplain Windmiller at the time, and we tried to lift the helicopter to get some of the wounded out there, the pilot and co-pilot. And then we were running out of ammunition, so they said, pull the ammunition for the 50 caliber machine, or not the 50, but the M60 machine gun, because the helicopter had quite a bit of that. So we kept trying to collect and move the wounded, and there were no helicopters willing to come in anymore, so we tried to carry them the best we could over to the boats that were waiting for us to retreat back on, so we could put them on there and they could get some medical assistance. And, you know, it's just one thing after the other. And then I ended up staying on one of the armored personnel boats, and with some of the wounded fellas, and one of the guys needed my weapon, so I loaned it to him. It was a sergeant that I knew was responsible. I did get it back. And luckily enough, that evening, I was getting dark out at the time, and I recall sitting in the boat facing another soldier. I don't remember who he was, but evidently a bullet or a piece of shrapnel hit right between us on the floor of the boat and sparked whatever it was, and it ended up peppering him with small pieces of shrapnel, and luckily enough, I didn't get anything. So I just count my blessings that I made it through that day.
Yeah.
That, again, like I said, that was probably the worst day of my life.
About how long does this engagement last?
Well, it was around noon when we were going to stop, and it lasted until it was dark out. So it was, depending on when, you know, the sun was setting, by 6 o'clock in the afternoon, and then through the evening there was still some battling going on, but not nearly as much. I mean, it was sporadic, and it was just a few shots here and there that it just, from what we understood and what we were told, was that the enemy pulled up and just hightailed it out of there before we got them all. But reportedly that we did get quite a few.
Mm-hmm. Now,
but I don't remember the numbers.
This is a pretty long engagement for this kind of activity.
Yeah, and then all night, and then the next morning I found out that my best buddy was missing. And I was pretty sure that he got it, because I was in talking distance with him when I was walking on the berm. He was on the water with the other infantry guys and in this boat. And I may have even hollered over to him and said something about how lucky he was that he was on the boat and dry, where I was covered with mud because we had been traipsing through the rice paddies. So little did I know that he lost his life that day.
And what was your friend's name?
Dennis Adamski. He was from Appleton, Wisconsin. And many years later, I visited Kansas City on business, company I work for now. And I knew that his brother had lived in Kansas City because we had visited there one time on a weekend leave from Fort Riley. And I picked up the phone book when I was in my hotel room, and I thought, I wonder if he's still in the area. And by darn, I found his name. I called, and his wife answered the phone, and I told her who I was. She didn't remember me by name, but she, when I mentioned that I was Dennis's best friend, she did remember me. She didn't remember my name, but she remembered meeting me when I went with them to their home. I ended up at their house, and they invited nephews and uncles and cousins, and had a family reunion, because they were wondering exactly how he made his fate. They were told one thing, and I hopefully set them straight.
And
they
were
told that he was hit by a mine or a landmine. I said, no, he was not. He was hit by a machine gun emplacement. So hopefully I set him straight. They said they would not tell his parents. And I think it was his mother was still living, but they said they wouldn't tell her. She was still up in Appleton, Wisconsin. But they were so thankful for me coming to meet them and talk to them that evening.
It seems that that would have been a difficult meeting. What was that like for you?
Oh, yes. It was it was interesting, but, you know, to meet them, and, you know, I had met the one that was a baby at the time, and then when I got there now, it was grown up and older teenager at the time. So it was interesting. I don't know how else to put it.
Yeah. Can you take me back to this engagement on the 19th of June?
Yeah.
Explain to me what it's like for you to be, or for anyone to be, in this kind of heavy contact, heavy firefight, and especially when it lasts this long. What's going through your mind? How are you reacting? What are you thinking about as you're going through this?
You want to get the enemy. You want to get them to stop firing. You want to have it all stop. You know, it's just, you talk about, being scared. Yes, you are, and, it's just, you're prepared for it, and you do the best you can. I don't know what else to say.
Yeah.
After that battle was over, the officer that was in charge that I was with at the time put me in for Army Commendation Medal with Valor because it was in combat.
And did you receive this award?
I received the award maybe, several weeks later.
Terry, after being in an engagement like this and losing a very good friend that you had and receiving a medal for your efforts there, what kind of feelings and thoughts do you have on this? Is it something that you feel the medal validates what you were doing? Is it something that seems inconsequential? Is it a mixture of the two? How do you react to that?
Well, I was definitely honored to receive it. I didn't think I did anything out of the ordinary, but because I stood and we were getting fired at, I was a pretty good target, but at the time I was pretty skinny, so I didn't make too broad of a target for him. I don't know. I feel sorry that Dennis lost his life and all the other soldiers that were with us that day, that got wounded and injured, maimed for life, and lost their lives. That was, like I said, it was a terrible, terrible day. And I don't know how else to put it. I'm thankful that he was looking after me that day and meant for me to keep moving on.
Yeah. When this engagement is over, do you go back to a base camp, or are you on the barge? Do you go back to the barge that night?
No, we didn't.
You stayed there?
I spent the night on that armored boat, and the next morning I rejoined my group, and they were wondering what had happened to me. They were worried that I was hit too in somewhere, but they realized that I got involved with the assistance with the helicopters and getting the wounded guys over to the boats so they could get some better medical treatment. So then the next day, we kind of just, cleaned up the area, got all the soldiers that were killed in body bags, and helicopter after helicopter and body bag after body bag. We put them into the helicopters, and they'd take off with them. There were too many to count. I just don't recall.
Yeah.
I just remember seeing them all laying there. It was, quite traumatic. And, you think back now today, I mean, it just brings tears to your eyes.
Yeah. So when you're there the next day, are you coming back? Are you heloed back afterward, after everything is policed up?
I don't recall. I think they took us back to the barge. I don't recall. It's kind of after that, it's kind of a blank as to what happened.
Yeah.
Just don't recall. But it must have been, just a relief that we knew we were going back to the dry boats again and safety.
Right.
But knew that maybe in another day or two or three that we'd be back out in the bush again.
What do you do when you go back after this engagement? I mean, is there a period where you decompress, where you collect your thoughts?
Yeah.
Tell me about that part of the experience.
Yeah, you get back on, you clean everything up, and especially yourself. Kind of relax, meet with the guys, share magazines, a lot of hot rod magazines that we were into at the time. We'd visit some of the infantry guys. They kept the combat engineer group, Delta Company, who I was with, a little bit separated from the other infantry guys. They kept us kind of together. Get good meals. Like I said, get cleaned up, write letters to home. Then I had the officer, or my squad leader at the time for the engineers, came up to me and said, "You need to collect Dennis Adamski's belongings and anything that you shared, you keep your items that you shared." We had a tape recorder. That was probably the only major thing that we had. It was just a small portable tape recorder, so we could take messages home. And then I was supposed to go through these things and pack them up so they could be sent back, and I was told that I might be accompanying the body back to the States for the funeral, but that was then canceled, which, I was looking forward to having the opportunity to naturally step back on the United States grounds again, but didn't happen. So we just kept moving forward. And like you said, decompress and just kind of relax and take it easy, wait for the next orders.
What is it like to deal with the loss of a close friend in combat, Mr. Grill?
Well, it was very, traumatic to know that, he had lost his life. When you found out for sure that that's what it was, and you hadn't seen, but you were told that he had passed away, and I don't know, just like, anybody else that you lose that's close to you. We had met in AIT, and we went through two AITs, as I maybe mentioned before, and then when we got back to Fort Riley, we just remained very close, visiting his family in Kansas, and, it's a real hardship.
Yeah.
Things that happened leading up to the moment when he was killed, I keep thinking back because we take turns on the boat, and one day he'd say, "I'll take the boat today. I want to stay dry. I want my feet to stay dry."
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd say, "Okay." So the next day that I say, "Well, I'd like to stay on the boat today," and we kind of got into a routine where we mix it back and forth. We can, "Okay, it's your day to go on the boat." And for some reason, that day, he wanted to go on the boat because he said he wanted to stay dry. His feet were bothering. And I said, "Okay, then I'll stay on the land." And then I think, could have been the other way. Just like that. Could have been the other way. I'll never forget that. That's hard to stomach at times.
Yeah, I'm sure. Can you tell me what the pace of your mission was like? How often are you going out? What are you going out on? These missions are all basically the same. You're working off the boats. You're working with the 9th Infantry. Explain that to me.
We'd be on the barges for about 4 weeks, and we'd go off with the boats, and it was, you'd stay out. Sometimes it was only for one day. You'd do a sweep of an area and find nothing, and, everything was hunky-dory. They'd let us, retreat back to the barge at night, take us back on the armored personnel boat. And then other times you knew you were going to go out for, 2 or 3 days, even though you might not run into anything, and sometimes you did, snipers. There were lulls. It always seemed like, we used to say, it must be payday, because it was the end of the month or something, and then we used to say, must be their payday, because that seemed to be when we hit the most combat situations, the heavier fire. Other times it was, just sporadic or boring as all get out.
Yeah.
Just be walking through the bush and come across villages, and you'd see all the children and women, but you didn't see any young men. You might see some old men, and didn't do anything. You just pass on through. Maybe, they'd offer you something to drink or something to eat. And it was, fairly friendly. Little did we know that maybe the young men that were out in the bush waiting to ambush us would be a sniper. Who knows? Sometimes it was very calm and peaceful, and then other times it was all hell breaks loose.
Yeah.
So it was hard to know what was going to happen. It was boredom at one point, and then, like I said, all hell breaks loose.
All right. Now, you've talked about this one particular firefight that you were involved in, engagement you were involved in June. Do any other of the missions stand out to you that do you recall?
One that we had in the Rundstadt area. That was Rundstadt Special Zone,
mm-hmm.
if you've ever heard of that.
Yes, sir.
We had to go out into the jungle area and set up for the night. We didn't really run into anything, didn't have any issues. But in that area, the tide would come in, and it would be, knee-deep water, so you'd lash your air mattress up so that it wouldn't float away and stay close to a tree or something where you could lash up to. And one night, we set out all of our perimeter security things. I had a Claymore mine that I put out to my front. And that night, we heard an explosion. And we didn't know what it was. So we thought, well, is it the enemy throwing a hand grenade or something into our location? Because it was fairly close. And then we found out that it was one of the infantry guys actually pulled the pin because he was scared that he might have heard something, pulled the pin on a grenade, but was holding it and was ready to throw it. But he didn't see anything or hear anything, and evidently he fell asleep. And his hand released, and the grenade went off. So that's what we heard. Well, then we had to bring in a helicopter to do medevac for him. But before that happened, we didn't know what this was, so they figured they're going to call in an artillery barrage. And the artillery was, behind us, the enemy in front. So they called in some rounds, and in the Rundstadt, it was so wet that when the shell hit, it was kind of shook like jelly on the land, or where we were. And that was one of the most terrible sounds that I ever heard, was an artillery shell going all over your head and landing maybe 50 yards, maybe closer, in front of you. It sounded like a freight train coming down the track. And when these rounds came in, the sergeant that was calling them in wanted them to correct and elevate because they came in too close.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for some reason, they didn't elevate. They dropped a little bit, and they came in closer, and they were right on top of us. So these, I guess they were 105 howitzers, coming in on us and just screaming as they were approaching, getting close. And when they hit, we didn't know who was going to get hit next because it was just all around us. Luckily, because of the muddy and wet area, none of the shrapnel went horizontal. Most of it just went up.
Mm-hmm.
So you get hit by a lot of mud and debris and things. And then, like I said, after that was all over with, and they figured, there was no enemy in the area, and they realized that it was this guy's grenade that went off, they got the helicopter in, and here's a helicopter coming down as low as he could over top of the trees, and the spotlight on, and we're thinking, oh my God, the enemy's going to see this and hear this. They're going to know where we're at. So the rest of the night, nobody slept. We kind of stayed awake because we didn't know what was going to happen. And then in the morning, when it started getting light out, I got brave enough to get up out of my position, walked over to where I had my Claymore mine. And I don't remember how long the cord was, but maybe 25 or 30 feet. I just don't remember how long the cord was. Maybe 50 feet. Needless to say, Claymore wasn't there anymore because it was where a round evidently hit during the night with one of those artillery shells. So that tells you how close they were. They were right on top of us.
Yeah.
So that was quite a night, too. I'll never forget that one.
Yeah.
Although it wasn't, there was no enemy combat going on. You know, it was all our doings.
Right. Well, it would make it no less terrifying, I would think, when you have 105s screaming in at you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if you might tell me what the morale of your unit was like there, whether it's the combat engineers or the infantry support or the infantry troops that you were supporting. How were they dealing with this kind of war?
Well, everybody seemed to be dealing with it just fine. When you were out in the bush, you try to watch your buddy back and try to get back safely. And when you were back to the bars or to the post, you were watching movies and having a good time and drinking beer and playing cards, trying to, get back to some type of normalcy.
Yeah.
Everybody kind of did the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, had pretty good morale, I must say.
Can you describe for me these barges that you were on? Were these LSTs?
Oh, boy. I have a book here that has a picture of one. And it may say, you could be right saying LST. Here it is. Let's see. Yes, converted LST Benawa was the one, and that had a helipad on the top.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one was the see the Benawa, but I don't see the other one. The other one it almost looked like a box. The Benawa looked more like a ship. I don't know if it was self-propelled or not, but the other one was just a floating box almost. I think it was called the Colton. Don't recall.
Oh, that's fine. Where would these be, where would they be docked? Where would they be anchored?
Well, they'd be floating right out in the middle of the Mekong River. And they'd be, anchored out there. And if we had to relocate for some reason, they'd pull them, the one that I'm familiar with, they'd pull it with a tugboat. They were never docked at a dock, per se. It was always out in the middle of the water, in the river.
Describe these LSTs for someone who may not be familiar with it. What kind of size are we talking about? What do they look like? What kind of facilities do they have? How is it being operated?
Well, like I said, the Benawa, or the Vernon County was another one, I think. Benawa and the Vernon County. It looked like a ship. The first one that I stayed on was very box-shaped, and it could hold, several, like a whole company of at least a company, maybe two, of infantrymen, plus us being the engineers. A lot of just barracks, or not barracks, but cots. Just like any ship that you'd think of, they just stack them on top of each other. It was maybe about four high. And I don't know how else to explain it. They were, trying to see if they had some dimension or something on. I wouldn't doubt they were.
Well, that's okay. We don't need that.
100 and some odd, more than that. They were maybe 200 feet in length, and I just don't recall.
Yeah,
I'd have to look at something and measure it up.
And these, of course, were operated by the Navy, but you guys were coming in from the boats and spending a couple, 3 days there to get your get resupplied and decompress a little bit, and then you would get orders to go back out again. That's the kind of the pace of it.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I could find a picture that I'm thinking of the one that I was on. But it's not to be.
Yeah, well, that's fine. That's fine. Well, you kind of alluded to some of the things that you would do when you were back on the LST. What sort of things would you in particular do?
Listen to music and write letters to home.
Mm-hmm. How often did you write home?
Every opportunity that you got. every time we were back on the boat, we'd at least send a letter. Maybe not every day, but as soon as you could, you'd write a lengthy letter and send it home. Because
mm-hmm.
you knew you were going to be going out again maybe in a couple days.
Right.
So you tried to keep in contact. And then we also did the talking letters mm-hmm. where we'd, with that tape recorder that I mentioned that we shared, that I shared with my buddy, we'd send tapes home so they could actually hear us. And then if there was any activity going on outside, we'd make sure that they could hear it.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of times there was some incoming, or outgoing, I should say, outgoing artillery rounds, and they could hear it. My dad would enjoy hearing that.
Yeah.
He knew what it was like. That's about the extent of it.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I didn't indulge in alcoholic beverages, and maybe I mentioned before, I only would drink beer if there was no soda pop around.
Mm-hmm.
a lot of guys like to party.
Right.
But, listening to music and writing letters to home and getting some good meals
mm-hmm.
and some good sleep.
And, of course, preparing for the next time out, which, like you said, maybe 2 days later, maybe 3 days later.
Right. You never knew, but it was usually at least they'd give us a day back.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day you'd hear it. And, okay, we're going out tomorrow. So 2 to 3 days back.
Yeah.
And then we pulled our time on that barge out in the Mekong River for maybe 4, maybe 6 weeks,
mm-hmm.
and then we'd go back to Dong Tam, and another group of infantry and combat engineer fellows would go out, and maybe another squad or another platoon to help the infantry.
Mm-hmm.
So when we were back, then we'd do the routine things that when we were back. We'd building bunkers and pulling perimeter guard and as I probably mentioned before, protecting the dredges
mm-hmm.
and running infantry guys out to different positions with the boats that couldn't get there by land because we had some locations that were quite remote and couldn't get to them.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd take them out with the boat.
And you'd be back for what, say 4 or 6 weeks, something like that?
Yeah. Same thing. We just take turns.
Right. Was it difficult to go back out?
Yes. You always hated to see it coming
because
you knew where you were going to see combat.
Right.
More so than you would when you were in camp.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the only bright side was the better meals. Always got better meals on the Navy. For some reason, they tasted better. They were cleaner conditions, because the barracks or in the mess halls that we had at the camp, it was okay.
Yeah.
It was a lot nicer on those boats.
What kind of food would they serve you on the boats?
Oh, you name it. Steak, ham, and eggs.
Hmm.
I was one to always make breakfast. I always enjoyed the eggs at camp and on the boat. Mashed potatoes, gravy, turkey, chicken, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
They always seem to have better selection and better quality of food than we did when we were back at post. Although our mess sergeants always did their best to do what they could. One of my favorites, because I was raised on, in the country where the farmland, we were raised on liver and all the food that a lot of other soldiers didn't quite like. When they had liver on the menu, I got all that I wanted. That was the best. Some of it didn't look too good, but you cover it up with ketchup.
Well, how did you guys in the Army get along with the Navy guys, get along with the sailors?
I thought we called well. I mean, we were protecting them as much as they were. They were more of our transportation and lodging. So they didn't have any issues with us. I always got along well with them. No, none at all.
Now, you also mentioned the Vietnamese that you would occasionally encounter when you're going out on one of these sweeps. What was your impression of the Vietnamese?
They were farm people. They wanted to farm their land, and the children and the women, they were all scared, but did what they could, because they had to watch what they did, because they'd be in trouble if they saw us, were known that they were too friendly to us.
Mm-hmm.
Never had any issues with them.
Yeah.
I felt sorry for the conditions that they had to live under.
Were you involved in any sort of MedCap operations, going out to the villages, helping them in terms of upkeep of health, or building buildings, or digging wells, or any of those sorts of things that we hear about?
I wasn't directly involved in any of those, other than sweeping, mine sweeping. We'd get reports that children, maybe stumbled upon something, and we'd go out and look for a mine that might have been planted somewhere. We used to do the highway all the time because, again, we were combat engineers. We had the mine sweepers, metal detectors, whatever you want to call them, go out and look for things that might have been planted in the road.
Can you tell me about doing this, going on a mine sweeping mission?
Yeah.
How would you go about this?
I'm sorry, what?
How would you go about a mine-sweeping mission, whether it's a road or a field or whatever it might be? Take me through that.
Well, every morning, before traffic would start, to ensure that it was clean, a lot of us would volunteer to go out, because it was pretty good duty, and you'd just sweep across, and if you did think you found something, you'd set a charge, a small one, blow it in place. They didn't want you to mess with it. And I remember one time it was very close to a school and all the children were up, and I did find something that was sticking up out of the ground, and it was metal, and we didn't want to put any pressure on it, so I just evacuated the school. We got you know, some of the infantry guys that were with us and other engineers got everybody moved back and set a small charge there and just blew it in place. And it was something, because it was, the explosion was bigger than what the charge I put there. But after that was gone, all the kids came running around and GI number one, GI. You know, because they could have got injured.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Even though it wasn't probably a personnel type thing, the weight of a person couldn't set it off. It would have been a vehicle or something.
Mm-hmm.
But to set it where they did, I can't believe it. You know, just anybody could have tread on it, you know, a vehicle.
Right. What kind of things would you find in the ground? What types of mines?
Again, we didn't mess with them. If we found something that we detected, we just blow it in place. We didn't dig around too much. Only one time we found wires that were going to something that was buried on the side of a road. Looked like for an electrical charge that somebody would sit back and detonate as a truck was going over it. And again, didn't investigate too much because we didn't know if it was booby-trapped.
Right.
So we just kind of put a charge as close as we could and blew it in place. So I never saw the explosive device, but we thought there was something there, so we'd do it.
And how would you go about doing that? Are you digging a hole close to it? Or are you just setting something on top of the area where you found it? How would you go about that?
And just setting something as close to it as possible or on top of it.
And what type of explosives would you use?
Well, at the time, I think it was C4, C3. Could have been Flex-X that you'd wrap around a blasting cap and just have a, you know, 1 minute fuse you'd cut for it. Blow it in place.
Yeah. Very interesting. Why don't we stop there for today, Mr. Grill? This is Kelly Krager continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Terry Grill. Today is 11 April 2013. I'm in Lubbock, Texas on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Mr. Grill is joining me by telephone again from his home in McCungee, Pennsylvania. Okay, Mr. Grill, you were talking about the time there at the Rungsat, and you were mentioning a couple of other missions that you were going out on. Could you please pick up the story there for me?
Yeah, the one that sticks in my mind is the June 19th battle that we had. There were others afterwards that were somewhat, you know, gray, a little bit fuzzy in my mind to remember all the details, but recall one time when we were walking across a field, and it was a pretty nice day, and everyone seemed to be enjoying the walk that we were having, and we hadn't run into any snipers or any of the enemy. But off in the distance, we did hear some explosions and gunfire, but it was well off in the distance. But yet, when we were walking across, one of our men said, I'm hit. Well, we didn't hear anything. And we all hit the deck, but we just didn't know where it was coming from. So did they have a silencer on their weapon, or was it a blowgun, or what? And nothing else happened. I mean, he just suffered a leg wound. And when the medics attended to him, they saw that it came down at a very sharp angle, you know, almost like, you know, 75-80 degrees. So was it a stray bullet from the other battle that was going on or something? We just didn't know. But all the while, he did get it in the lower portion of his leg, and it was a shell of some type. And as he was going out, put him on one of the armored troop boats, and he just waved at us and said, "I'm going home."
Huh.
One of those wounds that, you know, they might patch you up, but maybe you won't come back again.
Yeah.
Because of the leg wound.
Now, I wonder, had he fired his weapon at all?
No. No, everyone was just walking, and we think we remember hearing a whishing sound, but, you know, when he got hit, you know, it's like, okay, are they shooting at us with blow guns or silencers or whatever? And then the only thing that we can imagine would be that it was a stray bullet from where the other fighting was going on.
I'll be darned.
It was one of those. He was at the wrong place at the right time.
Yeah. That's kind of crazy when you think about it.
Yeah. Like I said, there were other battles, many others, but just don't recall some of the details on them. Once we got short, we didn't have to go out anymore. Once we were within 4 weeks of going home, they didn't make us go out in the field anymore, but they did put us on minesweep detail. I think I mentioned earlier that we were doing some of that. Some of the roads, the local roads that get well-traveled, and some of the, I think I mentioned about a school yard where some children were. But other than that, you know, that was pretty much the brunt of it. And once we got our orders that we were going home, you know, we just pulled duty right in Dong Tam at the camp, building bunkers or whatever. They didn't put us back out in the field again. I think it was like 4 weeks, something like that.
So you mentioned being short. I wonder if, even when, though your duties out on patrol and things like that may have been curtailed somewhat, I wonder if you were, how aware were you of being short, and did being short affect the way you approached your day-to-day activities?
Well, you were a lot more careful of what you did and or tried to do. You know, you had orders that you were following, you did what you had to, but... you know, just live day to day until that last day when you were going to get on a plane and go up to Saigon and get on a jet and come home. And that's at the Tonkinese Air Base, where we had a whole bunch of guys from my unit that were going out, because we all went over together at the same, you know, pretty much at the same time. So there were a lot of us that were friends, and we knew we weren't going to see each other again, because some of us left maybe a couple hours earlier for one flight, and some came back on a different. But I recall when I got on the jet at Tonkinu, we were thinking, please don't have them shooting at us as we're taking off. We want to get out of here. That was it, and we knew we were heading to San Francisco to be landing, and you know, we had a good old time on the plane. They were playing the music that we wanted to hear, and the flight attendants were more than happy to see us, you know, going home and entertaining and giving us pretty much, you know, all the beverages that we wanted, and you know. I don't think I slept the whole flight home. I don't remember how long it was, but it was first stopping in Guam. And I recall seeing the bombers lined up there, B-52s, I think it was. And we had maybe a four-hour layover for refueling and whatever in Guam, and then took off and made the hop into San Francisco, which was maybe 6 or 7, 8 hours. I don't even remember, but it seemed to go quick, but I guess I must have dozed off. I don't recall.
Yeah.
And the biggest treat was when we got into San Francisco, and we could start seeing the lights out of the plane. Everybody was cheering. The pandemonium set in, you know, on the plane, and they were playing a song that going to San Francisco, I don't know if you recall that one.
Yes, yes indeed.
And they played that on the plane as they banked, and into the airport, and everybody was cheerful, glad to be home.
Yeah.
And they did say that we might, when we land, meet some protesters on the tarmac as the plane pulled up, but I don't recall seeing any.
Okay.
Because of but that was the time it started getting, where a lot of protesting going on for us being over there.
Mm-hmm.
But I just don't recall seeing any at that time. Then we got on a bus, and I think they took us to Oakland, where we got mustered out. We got our remaining pay, and it was up to us to get in a cab and head for the airport and get a plane ride home.
So you were officially finished with the Army then,
as soon as you got in? They gave us an early out, because we only had like a couple weeks left.
Mm-hmm.
We got back in September, beginning of September, I think it was, and we were going to be getting out, in the beginning of October, so they let us, muster out.
Right.
And we were done.
Mm.
They said we had to pull reserve training or duty, but don't be expected to be called up because we were on active duty. We served our active duty and they didn't think we'd get called. I think that was for another 4 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I never got called. But when we did get back, I met my wife, and we got married, and I was working for my father. I think I mentioned that at the time, in a
mm-hmm.
metal fabricator shop. And I just missed the service and the camaraderie of the guys, and also the extra income. And if I stuck it out for a full good 20 years, so I could get a pension there. And so I joined the Army Reserves and served, I think it was 6 years there, until I got into the position of where I work now at the chocolate factory.
Mm-hmm.
When I had left my father, I got the position at the chocolate factory that was being built, and I just didn't have the time to put into the reserve, because they wanted us there almost every Wednesday night, although we just met once a month for our normal training, and then summer camp. But the position I had with being the battalion combat chief, it required that you be there almost every Wednesday night to put some time in.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't afford that, because it was putting too many hours in at the chocolate factory.
Right.
So I decided to get out after, I think it was 6 or 8 years that I put in there.
Hmm. So I wonder if you could tell me, what was your overall experience like with the military? How much did you enjoy it? Was it a positive experience for you? What was your time in the military like for you?
Yeah, I enjoyed it for the most part. I'm glad I had the experience, glad I got to see what I did. As I had mentioned way in the beginning, we didn't go on vacations, and I didn't see a lot of the world, and I got to see very much of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not some of the best parts, but I gained a lot of friendship with some of the other guys, and there are a few of them that we still keep in touch as we can on the email and occasionally a phone call. My best friend, Don Domini, who lives in California, is seeing the VA hospital quite too often, and I wish him well. I don't know if it's Agent Orange related or not, but he's suffering quite a bit, and I would like to see him. We have a plant in the San Francisco Bay Area, which would be about maybe 2 or 3 hours drive from where he lives. But someday I'd like to still get out there and see him.
Yeah. Now, Mr. Grill, did you continue to keep up with the Vietnam War? Were you reading the newspapers, watching the news? Were you still following what was going on over there?
Very little.
Very little.
Very little. I you know, I heard what was going on, but I didn't get into it much at all.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all. I'm paying a lot more attention to, you know, the Gulf War and Afghanistan and all that, and now I'm, every day I'm watching what's going on in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. In some way, I wish I could help.
Sure, sure.
But I can't. You know, I'm just too old for that anymore.
Now, shortly after you came home, the Tet Offensive in 1968 kicks off. What do you remember about that?
Again, not much. Hmm. I knew something was going on, but I was home and working and raising a family and didn't pay too much attention to it.
Yeah.
You know, I think it was about a year or so after I got back, I was married, and I had other things on my mind, not the war. I left that behind me.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I've only got a couple of more questions for you, Mr. Grill. And the first one is a pretty broad question, so feel free to answer it as you see fit. But as you look back on your time and your experiences in Vietnam, how do you think they have most affected your life?
Oh, I'm sure tremendously. A lot of guys say, you know, they can put up with more because you've been to hell and back.
Mm-hmm.
And I use that expression sometimes, jokingly, but I think that had a lot to do with what you do with the rest of your life. And definitely would love to go back to Vietnam and see the country now, because it was such a beautiful country, and get to see and understand more of the culture and the people. I grew up a lot, because a lot of people, when I got back and after they had read the story of how I got my Army Combination Medal, and they said, "When did you get the guts to do that?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, just did it. You think about it."
Mm-hmm. I've got just the last question for you, and again, a rather broad question. But as you look back on the American experience in Vietnam, the Vietnam War, what do you think will be the lasting legacy of the American experience in Vietnam? What is the legacy of the Vietnam War for this country?
Oh, boy. Like you said, that's a long question. As it was at the time, we thought we were doing absolutely what was necessary to fight back communism, but there were other underlying issues that we probably didn't know about, that came out later,
mm-hmm.
that kind of upset you. But I don't know. I think we have to be much more careful of where we get involved. I mean, sometimes you think over in the Middle East, what's going on over there. You think, what happens here, people don't come to help us. We're trying to help the world. And a lot of people say we should just stay home, but I know you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
You have to defend freedom for people. And if that's what it takes, that's what it takes.
Yeah.
That's about all I can say.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Grill, is there anything else you'd like to add before we close the interview?
Not that I can think of right now. I appreciate what you're doing out there.
Well, it's certainly our pleasure to do so.